Well, Mr. Secretary General, thank you so much. That was both powerful and thoughtful. And I just want to pick up on some of the themes you raised in your remarks. I was struck by your comment, and I'm paraphrasing, it may not be quite right, but that in how we think about engaging with Russia, we will be in the best position if it's a strong NATO that is working to build a constructive and cooperative relationship with Russia. And certainly at Wales, there was a decision about how to improve our readiness, but there's been a debate within the alliance about whether we're right to focus on a persistent force, having rotational forces go to the easternmost members of the alliance, or whether we should have a permanent NATO force deployed in those countries. And I'd just like your thinking on that difference between persistent versus permanent and whether we should be moving toward a more permanent presence there.
So, first of all, I think that my main message has been since I took office and also in this speech has been that there is no contradiction between being in favor of a strong collective defense, a strong NATO, investing more in defense, and at the same time being in favor of engagement with Russia. Actually, it's not a contradiction. We need a strong defense to be engaged with Russia in one way or another. And part of that message is that NATO is here to stay, Russia is here to stay, so we are going to have some kind of relationship. The question is not whether we are going to have a relationship, the question is what kind. And as I told, or as I tried to convey in my speech, is that the Norwegian experience is that by being part of a strong alliance, by increasing our defense expenditures in real terms, we created the basis, the foundations for also moving into or relating to Russia in a cooperative way. That's also the reason why I believe that the implementation of the Readiness Action Plan is so important for our relationship with Russia. And I very much welcome that we were able to reach an agreement in Wales, which is so strong, and which is completely in compliance with our international obligations and also with the Founding Act. So there is no violation of any international obligations related to our implementation of the Readiness Action Plan and the international obligations of NATO. And we have found a way to both increase our presence in the air, at sea and on land on a rotational basis, which provides the necessary increased military presence. We are going to have pre-positioning of equipment, of supplies, and also to establish command and control elements in our different Eastern allies. And we will do that, be there as long as needed. So I think that in a way, gives us the way to address the question of permanent or rotational. We have found a way to address that, which is in accordance with our international obligations, but at the same time reassures and assures our Eastern allies.
So do you think permanent basing of NATO troops in the East would abrogate the NATO-Russia Founding Act?
So the NATO-Russia Founding Act is the words there are about substantial combat troops, and what we are doing now is not about substantial combat, permanent basing of substantial combat troops, but we are increasing our military presence. We are doing that in many different ways, and the important thing is that we are doing it in a way which has the full support of all allies. We agreed on that in Wales and met with the government in Poland a few weeks ago. They very much welcome the Readiness Action Plan. What they are eager to see is that we are implementing it on time in full. And therefore, I think we are actually constructing a debate which we have left behind if we are erasing again the debate whether we're going to have permanent or not. We have found a way of dealing with that, which supplies the necessary assurance to our Eastern allies.
You also spoke in your remarks about, I thought you had this great comment about how both NATO and Russia are here to stay. They will have a relationship, and the question is what kind of relationship that will be. And there are some voices in Washington outside of government who have suggested that we need to do more to broker a compromise with Russia. And some of those individuals have been suggesting that we should put NATO membership for Ukraine on the table and say, we pledge that NATO will not accept Ukraine as a member, given what a sensitive point this is for Russia. Do you think that would be a sensible way to move forward?
The way we should move forward is to stick to what we have decided. And I was present at the summit in Bucharest in 2008 when we decided to state that Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO. Since then, Ukraine has decided not to apply. Therefore, that's not on the agenda. But the whole idea is that the open door policy has been a great success. It has enlarged the part of Europe which is now living in freedom, in democracy. It has enlarged the whole NATO. We are now protecting almost 1 billion people in Europe and North America. And we are still standing behind the ideas of open door policy. But as I said, Ukraine has, it has to be up to each country to decide whether they want to apply for membership or not. Ukraine has decided not to apply, so that's not the agenda now.
So clearly NATO has a challenge to the east. You also referenced the challenges to the south. And you mentioned your visit to Turkey, visiting the NATO Patriot deployments in Gaziantep. And I'm curious if when you were there, if your Turkish counterparts asked for any additional support from NATO. And beyond any requests from Turkey, you have said that if there were requests from Iraq for NATO help with training Iraqi forces, the alliance certainly would consider that. Beyond that, either additional support for Turkey, potential support for Iraq, are there other ways you could see NATO engaging in support of the anti-Islamic State coalition?
First of all, I think that we have to remember very clearly that the readiness action plan to make our forces more prepared, more ready, to establish this spearhead force and so on, that's an answer both to the challenges we see to the east, but also the challenges we see to the south. So when we see emerging threats, instability in the south, that's something which also requires the implementation of the readiness action plan and making our forces even more ready. So that's part of the answer to what we see to the south. This was something I discussed with representatives from the Turkish government, and they very much agreed on that approach. Second, we have already deployed the Patriot batteries, augmenting the capacity of their the air defenses. Turkey is a strong ally. They have the second largest army in NATO. So they didn't ask for any more NATO forces in Turkey. But of course, they underlined the same message as I did, that collective defense applies to all 28 allies, including Turkey. So we will protect every ally against any threat. And that, of course, also includes Turkey. Then there has been no request for a NATO role in Syria. I welcome that many NATO allies are taking part in the actions against ISIL. But it's not NATO as alliance who is taking part. There are different allies who participate in the US-led coalition. And I think that underlines that NATO is often NATO is often the answer to some to many crises, but NATO is not always the only answer. And we have to work together with others. And we have to try to develop more local strength. And that's the reason why we are now focusing more on defense capacity building measures, train, assist, advise local forces. And that's also the reason why we have in Wales agreed on the that we are standing ready to consider, if Iraq requests, to train, help them enhancing their own security forces. And I think that's something we should also apply for other potential crises, is to try to do more of training and advising to enable them to manage their own local problems without troops from abroad.
Mm-hmm. One final point I wanted to raise with you is you referenced that you're not only a former prime minister, but you're a former finance minister. And the debate about defense spending in the alliance is a long-standing one. And lots of people have tried to come up with new mechanisms of how to help generate political will and the ability to increase defense spending, accepting that there are real financial pressures on many of the NATO member countries. And one of the ideas that's been out there is, would it be helpful to involve finance ministers more in NATO conversations, either engage them in ministerials or have them come to summits? I don't know what you think of that idea, but I'm just interested if you have other thoughts on mechanisms that might be helpful as you try to manage this difficult issue in the alliance.
I believe it's important to speak to finance ministers because they are very important persons. but even more important are prime ministers and heads of state. And they were at Wales. And they made the decisions. And actually, I say they because I have participated on many summits, but I didn't participate at the Wales summit. So when I'm going to travel around to different capitals and urge different governments to make good on their pledges on defense spending, I'm going to help them doing what they have said they're going to do. And I believe that it's going to be a change, partly because this is the first time we have seen heads of state and government making such a clear pledge as they did in Wales. Partly because the security environment has changed. Now, after the Cold War, of course, there were arguments in favor of reducing defense spending. But now we are moving into more uncertain times, more uncertain security environment, and therefore there are strong arguments of increasing defense spending again after a long period of reducing them. And thirdly, I would like to stress that we have already seen some countries. For instance, Poland. I visited Poland recently, as I said, and they are increasing. Romania is increasing, and other countries are increasing. So we have seen in several countries that they have been able to give priority to defense, saying that the environment is changing. There is more instability, more threats, and therefore we have also to adapt to this changing security environment by investing more in defense.
Terrific. And there are a lot more questions I could ask you, but I know that all of you in the audience have questions too. So I'm going to go ahead and open it up. The first hand I saw was right here, and then we'll come back to you.
Thank you.
And please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Jacques Rosier. I'm a retired admiral. I'm presiding the Euro-Atlantic Association, and I'm in one of the Atlantic Treaty Association's Vice President. Thank you for allowing me to put a question to you, Mr. Secretary General. At the recent seminar in Rome at the NATO Defense College, the issue of the 2% was thoroughly discussed. And your answer to the last question and also your statement in engaging to keep the pledge is very clear for a military. But in Rome, the conclusion was that the 2% pledge was either a tendency or a political statement. And if you look to the budgets from the Eurozone that have been introduced to the Commission recently, all the budgets of the countries have budget cuts in defense. So my question again after the moderator's question is, what do you have as mechanism in your political talks? at the European Union, something as financial acts are possible, les amendes, as we say in French, but nothing equivalent except political statements exist in NATO. And under this political statement was an underlying argument. What can NATO do with the sudden big increase in money? Thanks to Germany, bigger countries, if they double their budgets, what would NATO do with all this money? What are the capabilities needed, politically agreed? So, Mr. Stoltenberg, I know this is a very annoying question, but for a military having given its career and seeing the capabilities going down, what is coming up to make NATO strong again?
It's not an annoying question. It is an important question because I think it's an important issue to address the question of implementation. We made many good decisions at Wales, at the summit. Now the time has come to implement. And one of the most important decisions we made were related to defense spending. But just to be very specific, we actually said three things. The first thing we said was to stop cutting, just to stop the reductions. That's absolutely possible because we have seen reductions for so many years, and I think there is a very strong understanding that this can't continue. The other thing we said is that those countries who are above 2%, they should remain at above 2%. And the third thing we said was that we, during the next decade, are going to aim at increasing towards 2%. So the most immediate goal was to stop the reductions. I accept that that's a great challenge. But what I'm said and what I tried to underline both in my speech and also in the last answer is that this is not something I or NATO try to push on the allies. It's something they decided. So what we are doing, what I'm doing, is to help them to do what they self have decided to do themselves. And that should be possible. And I agree with you that it's a political decision, it's a political statement. But in democracies, that's the way we make decisions. It's by meeting as politicians, in parliaments, in governments, in alliance as NATO, we make decisions, and then it's up to us to implement them. I cannot guarantee you for the all 28, but what I can say is that I'm going to spend much time trying to convince all the leaders to implement, also on the defense pledges. And I have seen some very important examples. I mentioned Poland, Romania, but there are also others who have at least stopped the reductions, but also gradually started to increase.
Yes, the gentleman in the third row from the back. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Brooks Tignor. I write for Jane's Defense. I want to come to the same subject but from a different angle and not talk about what the woulds and the shoulds and the needs, but what's more likely. And that is the Allies gave themselves 10 years to raise their spending up to the 2% recommended level, as we all know. But the continuing financial crisis and public opinion, frankly, means they're going to need all 10 years and probably more to achieve that. And this is going to have a constraining effect on NATO. And that's the essence of my question to you. Where and how do you see this 10-year lag constraining what NATO can do to meet the security challenges it faces? I'm not asking you to give us the silver lining in it like all your predecessors have done. It's fine that Romania and the others are raising their defense spending, but this is not a game-changing increase for NATO as a whole. So where do you see the constraints? Some concrete examples. Do you think it's going to slow down missile defense? Is it going to restrict what the NATO allies can do in the eastern frontier? Give us some examples, concrete examples, of where you think this may have an impact. Thank you.
The strength of NATO is that we are democracies, 28 democracies. The disadvantage of a democracy is that it's not one person that decides. And that's, as I say, it's not a problem. It's a good thing. And therefore, we have to rely on 28 nations, 28 parliaments, and they are making their decisions. My responsibility is to convey the message from Wales, reminding them on what they agreed on in Wales. I'm not going to give you a list about what we will not be able to do if we are not implementing the defense pledge, because my responsibility is to do what I can to convince all countries to make good on the pledges they made in Wales. And we have a comprehensive defense planning process within NATO. We have listed actually some shortfalls. That's also an advantage with democracies and alliances as NATO, is that we are transparent and open also about shortfalls. And those are the shortfalls we are going to address, also through increasing our defense spending.
Super. The woman in the pink. And we did not color coordinate.
Hi, Terry Schultz with National Public Radio and CBS. Mr. Secretary General, you were just in Turkey and heard firsthand about the very complicated situation that Ankara faces with regard to ISIS in general, but very specifically Kobani. The U.S.-led coalition would like to see Turkey do more, would like to perhaps use Incirlik Air Base, and Turkey has said no. Do you think that Turkey, as a NATO ally, needs to do more to protect NATO's border against ISIS, against the Islamic State? And how, in your first month, are you managing these new tensions among the allies? Thanks.
Thank you. So, Turkey is doing a lot because Turkey is receiving hundreds of thousands of refugees. And Turkey is the country most affected by the crisis, both in the NATO ally, most affected by the crisis in both Iraq and Syria, therefore I commended when I was in Turkey the huge effort Turkey is doing to take care of all the refugees that are coming into their country. In addition, I know there is a close dialogue between the United States and Turkey on how they can work together in fighting ISIL. I met with General Allen when I was in Ankara, and the operations, the airstrikes in Syria is, as I said, a U.S.-led coalition. It's not something NATO is doing. Our main responsibility is to defend the borders of all our allies, and that includes Turkey, and that's the reason why we have the Patriot deployment in Turkey.
Yes, there are two questions over on that side. We'll go ahead and take both of them and try to be as brief as you can.
Maybe because it's linked to my colleague's question. My name is Wasim Rahim, working for a Safir newspaper. Secretary General, normally you speak more about what you're already doing. So why you didn't speak about the coordinating role that you already mentioned that NATO is playing between the alliance in Iraq and Syria? You mentioned already that there is a coordinating role that NATO is playing in this coalition. But can you clarify more what kind of coordinating role? Because we know that the NATO alliance is made to coordinate. So what specifically you are doing there? And the second question is about the foreign fighters' threat. You didn't mention this today, and we know when you don't mention something, it's not a coincidence. So are you taking a step back? Thank you.
No, we are not taking a step back, but I think that it's not possible in a speech to mention everything NATO is doing. So even if I didn't mention it, we are still doing it. And we are following up also on what we decided, and that is to increase information, the exchange of information related to the returning foreign fighters, which is posing a threat to our societies. to fighting terrorism and to deal with the threats posed by returning foreign fighters is partly an issue we address within NATO, and we are increasing the exchange of information, which is crucial for being able to deal with the threat. But it's also, of course, something which the European Union, different nations, police, intelligence are deeply involved in. So this is an area where it's not NATO alone. It's NATO together with other partners, allies, that are addressing the challenges related to the homecoming of foreign fighters. We have also a role when it comes to coordinating relief and assistance. And we are also following up on that. And even if I didn't mention that, we are also doing that. When it comes to Iraq, then we had this decision where we said that we stand ready to consider helping Iraq in enhancing their security forces if there is a request. So far, there hasn't been any request. But as I said, many NATO allies are taking part in the US-led operations together with regional partners, both when it comes to humanitarian aid, training, but also, of course, the airstrikes both in Iraq and in Syria. So NATO is often the answer to different crises, but often we are not the only answer. And what we see in Syria is a crisis or a situation where we also have other actors taking part, not only NATO.
And the gentleman right in front of the previous.
Jim Neuger from Bloomberg. I wanted to approach the defense spending question from yet another angle. The pledge runs for 10 years. Your tenure at NATO will be roughly half that time. Will you set any interim targets, perhaps year by year, perhaps for the duration of your time at NATO, for countries to meet? And if so, will you publish those targets?
I'm not planning to set any interim targets, but I will just underline that what we have decided is at least two things. One is to stop the reductions, and the other is to gradually to increase over the next decade as our economy grows. And so my first and most immediate target is to stop the decline in defense spending. And as I said, that's a challenge. But I also underline that that's possible, partly because I think the understanding in the different capitals that the security environment has changed is really present. It's something they understand and feel. And partly because we have seen some countries who have been able to at least stop the decline and gradually start to increase. But again, these are 28 parliaments who are going to decide. But I will going to use those countries who are increasing as an examples for the others, to inspire them to do the same.
And there are a lot of hands, so I'm just going to ask everyone to be as concise as possible. We had two right up here in the front.
Yeah. Thank you. John Dahlberg from the Associated Press. Secretary General, as you said, crises beyond NATO's borders can affect the security of NATO member countries. I was wondering, if you could tell us what, if anything, NATO is doing now faced with the Ebola crisis, and if you think that NATO or its members should do more. Thank you.
The Ebola crisis is very serious, and I very much welcome the efforts which many different countries now are taking to fight the Ebola crisis. Many of them are NATO allies. United States, UK are in a lead role in much of the efforts, and what we are doing is that we are in contact with the UN to discuss whether there are any specific role for NATO. But again, I think that we have to understand that Ebola is really a serious threat. The world reacted to slowly and too late, but now real efforts are being made by the UN, by UK, US, and other countries, and of course the countries in the region. And NATO allies are contributing. The question is not whether NATO allies are contributing in fighting Ebola, but the question is whether this is best organized through a NATO structure. And that's too early to say, but we are in dialogue with the UN.
Nawab Khan from the Kuwait News Agency, Kuna. Sir, you referred to partner countries. So what are your plans to beef up cooperation with the Gulf countries in the region? And my second question is on Afghanistan. There are concerns in the region that when NATO leaves Afghanistan, it would lead to more insecurity and turmoil in the region. Your comments. More insecurity and turmoil when NATO leaves Afghanistan.
On Afghanistan, I would like to underline that the main objective of the NATO mission, ISAF mission in Afghanistan, was to prevent Afghanistan being a safe haven for terrorist organizations. And that goal we have achieved. And then in addition, we have contributed to social and economic development in Afghanistan. Millions of children are attending school, many of them girls. And compared to the situation in 2001, 2002, Afghanistan and the world is safer because of what we have done in Afghanistan, our presence there. And we have seen economic, social progress. Then, of course, Afghanistan is not a perfect society. And when we leave, there is still going to be fighting, instability, and uncertainty. But what we have done is to create the conditions for a stable, united, and democratic Afghanistan. But then we hand over the responsibility, the full responsibility for the security, but also the future of Afghanistan to the Afghans themselves. We have trained a force of 350,000 soldiers and police. We have seen the first peaceful transfer of power after a democratic election. And we have seen the establishment of a unity government. And NATO is going to remain there in another capacity, in the Resolute Support mission, training, advising, assisting the Afghan forces, but based on the clear understanding that now the responsibility of the security is the hands of the Afghans. We are just assisting, helping, training them. So, yeah, that was Afghanistan. The other question was about... we are going to... We have a close cooperation with the Gulf states. We have the Istanbul Cooperation
Initiative,
which we are going to have a meeting. We are planning to have a meeting in the near future in that context or that frame. And I think it is important to keep up the dialogue because we are seeing so much instability, so many challenges in that region, and therefore I very much believe in dialogue because it's better to talk together, to understand each other, than to not have dialogue and then undermining the foundations for political cooperation.
Super. And there was a question on this side in the back. I don't know if they're still there, and then one here on the corner. Yeah. Yeah, please.
Thank you, Secretary General. I'm Tomasz Meseric. I'm a member of the European Parliament from Hungary. And I would like to go back to the Eastern problem, the problem on the border of the East. And not the military side of it, but the political rather. Some of the newer NATO member states, most notably Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia, have become less than sanguine about NATO troop presence on their soil. Actually, some of them explicitly stated that these new troops would be unwelcome. This sort of reflects less than a 100% agreement about the Eastern policy, at least the military side of it. What are you going to do about it? Are you planning to visit any of these capitals in the near future? Thank you.
I am planning to visit all NATO capitals, and I have started to do so, and I am leaving for Greece tomorrow, and I am going to visit all capitals of all NATO allies. Second, there is an agreement in NATO that we are going to have more forces exercising training deployed on rotational basis in our eastern allied countries. There is agreement in NATO that we have increased our air patrolling, air policing fivefold. And there is full agreement in NATO that we're also going to deploy elements of command and control and the pre-positioning of equipment and supplies in Eastern Allied countries. So what we are going to do is to implement on that, and our military authorities are now working on the detailed plans, and we are going to decide on the design, the scope, the size of the spearhead force on our ministerial meeting in February.
Super. And yes, the gentleman here.
Thank you. My name is Yalcin Mamadov from ENews.az. Secretary General, I wonder if a membership action plan will be offered to Georgia, or you will continue with endless deeper and deeper integration, and if existing territorial conflicts will affect this perspective, or you will avoid a presence in the South Caucasus because of Russia. Thank you.
The open-door policy of NATO has been a great success. I was present at the summit in Bucharest where we decided to on Georgia. My responsibility now as Secretary General is that we are implementing the comprehensive package we have agreed on. And I'm going to meet with the Prime Minister of Georgia quite soon to discuss the implementation, the follow-up of this comprehensive package for Georgia. In addition, I would like to underline that Georgia is really a strong partner. And Georgia has participated in many NATO operations. They have provided valuable contributions to our operations in Afghanistan. And I also welcome the reforms, the progress that Georgia has made, especially related to their armed forces. We will continue to work together with Georgia and to implement the package we agreed on in Wales.
And there's a gentleman here on the end, and then the two women in the second row. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Christopher Hammerlund, European Commission. Thank you, Mr. Secretary General. Coming from a small country, as I do, Sweden, we've just seen back in Sweden, or I've seen it on news, staying here, but I've seen the biggest military ramp-up since the 1980s, looking and searching for a foreign submarine. I'm staying short of saying anything more, but the links and the allegation, well, the links and allegories to the head for the hunt for the Red October in an October month, of course, comes to mind. Nevertheless, Sweden is a neutral country, as is Finland, and has been neutral for many years. Is the time up for being neutral? Should Sweden, and here I'm seeking your advice back to Sweden and the Swedish fellow friends in this debate that follows now, should Sweden join NATO? Your predecessor said, well, you can't think that NATO will actually defend you in case of a conflict. You'll have to stand up on your own. The 28 are for 28. And you're not part of those 28. So should Sweden now rethink its policy? Should the, links with NATO become stronger and more, direct, as you have an open-door policy? What is your advice to Sweden and even Finland? Thank you.
I have the very strong feeling that both as a former Norwegian politician and as the Secretary General of NATO, it would be very unwise if I started to give advices to Sweden. So I leave that to the Swedes. The union between Sweden and Norway was abolished in 1905. And to some extent, the Swedes had to decide. What I can say is that we have an excellent relationship with Sweden, both as a former Norwegian Prime Minister, but also as Secretary General of NATO. I can say that because NATO has a close and very constructive cooperation with Sweden. We welcome that cooperation. Sweden is a partner of NATO, participating in many of our operations in Afghanistan and other places, and I welcome that. But I really mean that if I start to, even if I had an opinion, I should not tell anyone. So thank you for a good question.
And we had two women over on the side in the front, please. No, right behind you, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary General. Thank you for your presence here. My name is Hara Yeryadu from Bridging Europe, and I would like to draw your attention to the tensions going on right now in the Eastern Mediterranean that are causing friction not only between Turkey and Cyprus, that is a very traditional friction going on for the last 40 years, but also between member states, NATO member states, such as Greece and Turkey. Where is NATO standing as an alliance regarding this issue? Thank you.
And you can feel free to pass it to your neighbor. We'll take her next. But please go ahead, Mr. Secretary General.
So this is a bilateral, so the relationship between Turkey and Greece is a bilateral issue between Turkey and Greece. And in addition, NATO is not involved in the efforts to try to find a solution related to the problems we see in Cyprus. And that's part of my obligation as Secretary General of NATO, is to be very clear what's my responsibilities, what are the issues I'm going to address, what are the conflicts I'm going to work on and NATO is addressing, and which issues are not on my agenda. And the relationship between Turkey and Greece is a bilateral relationship, and I find that they are working together in NATO. I'm going to visit Greece tomorrow and Thursday, and the bilateral relationship between two member countries is not something we're going to solve within a NATO or to address within a NATO framework.
Super, thank you. Please.
Good morning. My name is Johanna Bouquet. Back to your speech, you speak about the key role of NATO in terms of crisis management and its responsibility in terms of stabilization and reconstruction. Back to 2011, NATO intervened in Libya. And what happened there was considered as a direct threat for Europe. So I was just wondering what are the concrete measures in terms of reconstruction for NATO, and what are the means of NATO in terms of reconstruction in this specific example? Thank you.
In Libya. So I think that what has happened in Libya is, in a way, illustrating a dilemma and also a challenge for the whole international community. NATO acted in Libya on a very clear UN mandate, and the military operation, which the purpose of was to defend the civilian population against the regime that was killing its own people. That military operation was actually a success. We achieved the goal of the operation. But after that, the international community was not present. It was too little focus on reconstruction, on the political process, on building the peace after the end of the NATO airstrikes in Libya in 2011. That's not necessarily the responsibility of NATO. Our responsibility was to conduct the military operations, but the international community as such, the UN, the European Union, and NATO, we had too little focus, and it was not clear who was responsible for the follow-up. And therefore, I think that we should discuss both within NATO, but also with our partners, other international organizations, the UN, EU, lessons to be learned from Libya. And I think that's partly is very much related to that we have to do something also after the end of the military operations. We have to focus on development, on political processes, not necessarily as NATO. It might be the responsibility of other international organizations, but someone has to take that responsibility after military operations as those we saw in Libya.
Thank you. The gentleman here in the third row, up in the front. And I'll already put out the warning that we're not going to get to everybody. We do have a hard stop at 11:30, but I'm trying.
Mr. Secretary General, my name is Kurt Engelen. I'm the Vice President of the Euro-Atlantic Association of Belgium and also a lecturer in international relations. In the new strategic concept of NATO, 2010, there are three points. There is the role for NATO as an organization capable of managing crisis. There is the recognition that there is an added value in a comprehensive approach to a crisis. And then there is what you just mentioned, the cooperation with partners. The three bring me, of course, to the relation between NATO and the EU and to the possibilities that these two organizations have to work together. Now, knowing that one of the issues standing in the way of that is Cyprus and that there are ongoing negotiations, which actually might end up with a solution quite soon, shouldn't NATO or wouldn't NATO be more involved in stimulating a solution in Cyprus because NATO and EU have a lot to win from each other? Thank you.
So again, NATO is the answer to many problems, to many crises, but not to all crises and all problems. Sometimes, actually, it is important that NATO don't go into problems or crises. It can just make it more difficult. And Cyprus is a question which involves Cyprus, Turkey, Greece, two NATO allies, and therefore I don't think that it will be good for the purpose of finding a solution that NATO as an alliance got more directly involved. I welcome the efforts that are now being made to try to find a solution. It's my good old friend Espen Barth Eide, who was the Minister of Defense and Foreign Minister in Norway for many years. And we were together. We have been working together in politics since he was 14 and I was 18. And he is a very clever young man, and I think that the best thing I can do is to, in a way, leave it to him, support him, and he will be on the phone immediately if I now started to assist him in solving the problems in Cyprus in this context. So leave it to Espen.
Excellent. And there was a woman in the back row who had her hand up. Yes, please.
Hello, my name is Emma Hoppes and I'm an intern at the European Parliament. I'm also from Sweden, so I have some questions about Sweden. I know that you already said that you can't give advices to government of Sweden if they would like to join NATO or not, but do you think it would be important for Sweden to join NATO from Sweden's point of view? And do you think it would be important for NATO that Sweden would join? Or do you think it would be more like a problem because Sweden is a neighbor to Russia as well? And how would that change the rules and the relations to Russia if Sweden would join? Thank you.
So, very good questions, and I'm not going to answer them. So, because we are back to that, my responsibility as Secretary General of NATO is not to comment on all possible issues or to give advice to all possible international actors. If I would like to do that, I should start some kind of consultancy, and then I could can give you advices. Yeah. But I'm not in that business. I am responsible for 28 allies and what we are going to do as an alliance. And therefore, I just have to be very clear that what Sweden wants to do with the question of applying for membership or not is up to Sweden. What I can say is that we are conducting our open door policy. We have the decisions you have taken several times that we are an open alliance, 28 democracies, and we are very much appreciating the cooperation with Sweden as a partner.
And I know there are a lot of hands up, but the last question is going to come over here to the gentleman in the second row.
Yes, hello. My name is Henrik Vasallo from Saab. I'm also from Sweden, so the third time, so I hope you can answer this question. This is not about Sweden, though. You mentioned in your third priority the strengthening of the bond between the U.S. and Europe, and you also mentioned that you would be in contact with the new European institutions. The timing is quite good for that, I would say, because the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, is being negotiated as we speak. But defense is excluded from that, or at least it's not part of the TTIP as was, for the moment. Do you think that defense should have a clearer role together with security in the TTIP negotiations?
So first of all, that's a trade, free trade agreement, and defense and defense investments has, very often been excluded because it has been regarded as something different than the trade in other commodities, other industries. And I think also it has something to do with that very many nations are very eager to have their own national defense industry. I think one of the challenges we are facing in NATO is how we can both respect, in a way, the natural need and the natural wish of many nations to have their own defense industry, but at the same time working more closely together to reduce costs, to have smart defense initiatives, and to find ways of working more closely together, both within Europe, but of course also Europe and North America. So that's already on the agenda. I don't know whether that will be wise to put into this already very complicated free trade agreements or negotiations.
Well, Mr. Secretary General, I think you should feel buoyed by the fact that we could continue on for certainly another hour and a half based on the very many hands that have been up. And I'm thinking back to a year ago when the NATO summit in Wales was being planned and people were asking questions about the relevance of NATO and what's its mission. And it's clear that people in this room not only appreciate the mission NATO is playing in everywhere from Afghanistan to Ukraine, but that people see other missions for NATO, whether it's Ebola or Sweden joining, but I'm also buoyed not only by the incredible command of what is in a very extensive brief that you've shown here, but the wisdom that you've shown in all of your answers, and also the sense of humor that we've seen, most particularly when it comes to Sweden. But I think it will be that mix of wisdom and keeping a perspective that allows you also to have a sense of humor that will be so valuable not only to the 28 of us who call us members of this proud alliance, but to all the other parts of the world to which this alliance is important. And I'm going to ask everyone in the room to join me in thanking you, but also wishing you great success in this role.
Thank you.